The issue we settled on for this week, picking up on the last thing we left off with last week, is the line between policy and PSAC, and related questions of why is it legitimate to incorporate policy into PSAC, and when a post-take does that, how does that happen? And what exactly does it mean for something to be mere policy rather than halakha, and how does a post-take present it, and all of those related questions. So that's the topic we want to take up. So let me share the screen here.
Would you define policy?
So that's going to be part of the issue here. But for now, let's say, well, you know, before I define it, what do you think? What could policy mean in this context? Right? I'm you know, could have been any words, but
can it be something like, I'll just pull out the women card. Like, women cannot say Dvar Torah in front of the men. Or something like
that. Right, so that might be an instance of policy, but what makes that policy versus PSAC?
Because there's nothing in the anywhere that discusses that particular. I don't know.
No, okay, no, that's exactly right. Meaning, what Malgi said is exactly where I would define it. Right, meaning where I would put policy. Is things that are not, at least not obviously so, halachic issues per se, right? And yes, when it comes to women's issues, often what's invoked is arguably not halacha, or in some cases, explicitly not halacha. Sometimes it's just exactly that. It's policy, meaning a post-ex says, I don't think this is a good idea for reasons X, Y, and Z, and therefore I advocate against embracing this, even though I can't say, I don't want to say, that it's actually forbidden, right? But in general, what I mean by policy for these purposes is anything which is not straight halakha. Right, which is not law. It's not a matter of law. It's not even a matter of custom. Meaning, what's driving the decision is an assessment of, let's say, communal circumstances, and a belief of what's best for the community, even if the post-ig doesn't believe that there is a direct halachic rule at play. Okay? Now, obviously, part of the problem is that sometimes the line between those is ambiguous, right? Meaning some people might think that something is halakha, and the argument isn't whether this is halakha, sorry, isn't whether we should forbid something or whatever, which is not halachic, which is not a halachic issue, rather, but rather whether or not halakha is there. So in that sense, and I see that that Matt has a question, but just one second, right? Meaning, we really could talk about this at two levels, right? One is, when do extra halachic factors affect the psak that I accept, right? Meaning, if the halacha is ambiguous, do external factors affect which halachic decision I take? Or, what I'm going to do, at least for the beginning here, is even if I acknowledge that this is not halachic, according to anybody, or at least I'm not convinced it's halachic, so I have no reason to forbid it, let's say, on halachic grounds, but I don't think it's a good idea, right? Is that a legitimate reason for me to nevertheless issue a stringent, I'll call it a ruling, but we'll see whether it's really a ruling, but issue a statement that I oppose it using my authority as posik? Okay, that's about a little bit ambiguous, but that's on purpose. Okay, what's your question?
No, what's the question? What a comment by Malki said, because while those of us on the phone may agree that women's issues are more policy as opposed to PSAC, I think any post-say aligns its issues leaders has to have an awful lot of humility to admit and to say that this is not really halakha, but it's more of policy. You think most of us deal with women's issues, you talk about sneer, things like that. Anybody who's coming out with a psak in this area, they're all coming out as if it's an issue to Elisa and absolutely not halakha. We're not saying that's policy at all.
Okay, so Matthew's point is true in many circumstances, but that all is not always true. I have an example that I put on the sheet of a posek who did not feel that way, a posek who opposed certain innovations in women's issues. We'll see what it was in a second, but explicitly said this is not an issue of halakha. This is my personal opinion of what is best for the community. It's not halakha, I think it's mutter, but I think it's a bad idea, right? You're right, not everyone is that clear, and that's exactly what I want to talk about today, which is how do we deal with that, and is it legitimate to blur the lines between those, or if you think it's just a bad idea but not forbidden, do you have to say that and hope that people listen to you? And that's really the question that I want to deal with. So the first source I put here, I won't read through the whole thing. This is an excerpt from an article in Tchumen Lamed Chet. Tchumen is one of the most widely read annual halacha journals here in Israel. Covers a relatively large swath of the community. With definitely within the religious Zionist community, but also, you have routinely articles by chief rabbis, by at least some members of the Haredi world as well. So in Lamed Chet, which was 2 years ago, I think they're up to Mem or Mem Aleph, so Rav Shlomo Dykovsky, full name Rav Rafael Shlomo Dykovsky, who was one of the most prominent judges in the Bet Din here in Yerushalayim. He wrote an article called Psikat Halacha U'Medinuyut Psikat Halacha, Halachic Rulings and the Policy of Halachic Rulings. This is what he writes. He writes, Psikat Halacha Ina Shaveh L'chol Nefesh. במקרים מסוימים הפסיקה היא חד משמעית, ואין המשתנה מאדם לאדם ומתקופה לתקופה. So halachic rulings are not the same for all people. There are specific instances where the law is can only be interpreted in one way, and therefore it doesn't change from person to person or time to time. But במקרים אחרים הפסיקה משתנה. In other cases, the halachic rulings do change. Leploni poskim kach ulamoni acheret. That for one person we rule X, and for someone else we rule Y. B'tkufa achat poskim l'chiyuv l'heter, or b'tkufa acheret l'shlilal l'ishur. Sometimes we permit, sometimes we forbid. And he says, homiletically, ulai nitan l'achnin zot b'dvarav shel Shlomo HaMelech b'sefer Kohelet. We could sort of stuff this into what Shlomo said. Eight lishmor, the eight lahashlich, that there's a time to guard and a time to discard. Eight lahashot, eight lahadaber, a time to be silent and time to speak. Eina chavana rak linosim shonim. That doesn't just mean in different topics. Elagam lo tonose. Even in the same topic, sheliitim yesh lahashot beyachad elav ulitim lahadaber. Sometimes it's better to be silent about an issue and sometimes to talk. Leitim lishmor alav, leitim lashlicho, sometimes to guard something and sometimes give up on it. Et hapsikot hayelchatiyot achad masher yichol livso kol rav habaki balacha. Said, straightforward halachic issues, any competent rabbi, posek, can weigh in. Lidupa b'dinei brachot, right? A regular straight-up halacha in hilchot brachot, right? Okay, what bracha do you make on pretzels? Mizono, right? I mean, okay, you know, not a big deal. You don't, right? There's not much going on there. Et ha-psikot ha-mishtanot, lefias kufa lefias shoel, but the things that change based on time or the person, yachol l'sok rav gadol. You need a bigger, a higher level rabbi, sheish lo achrayut siburit, who feels and has communal responsibility, v'shem mitzugah lavil ben kodesh lechol ben kodesh lechodesh, and who can distinguish between what's holy and not. And then he quotes a phrase from Rav Avram Shapira that there's a difference between what he calls a Rav and a Rebbele, which was his sort of denigrating way of, right, you know, level one rabbis, right, the major league postgame and minor league postgame. And different questions require different level. Okay, that's his introduction. Now, here, again, he is using policy to mean even cases where the external issues affect halakha itself, right? They motivate you to rule that something's forbidden or permitted, meaning within the halakhic system, rather than saying this is not halakhic and yet I have an opinion. But his argument can basically cover both. So then he has this interesting thing, which I'll tell you outside. He says, what's his proof that we care about this? That we care about taking in the bigger picture and letting that shape the decisions we make? So he, to this end, he quotes a well-known story. The reason it's well-known is because it's one of, you know, about 5-6 things that we routinely learn on Tisha B'Av. So, you know, on Tisha B'Av when we're fasting and we don't have much to do, inevitably, I assume most of us have heard, you know, the same shirim over and over and over again. Why you Torah every year? What Tisha B'Av, ironically, Tisha B'Av, which is the day you're not allowed to learn Torah, is the day that why you Torah is most visited every year, because everyone's stuck at home and they want to hear kinnot, they want to hear commentary on kinnot, they want to hear commentary on Eicha. But for those of us who want a Gemara shir, there's very limited. And what we have is the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, right? The story of, right, I see a bunch of nods of recognition, right? This is not a esoteric story. We all know this, that one of the stories of Enemigas was destroyed was because you had a person who had a friend named Kamsa and an enemy called Bar Kamsa. He invites the wrong person to the meal. He gets kicked out in a very terrible way. And in order to get his revenge, he decides to get the Roman Empire angry at the Jews, convince them that they're rebelling. So what he does is he tells the emperor, look, the Jews have rebelled. You want to prove it. So send them an animal as a sacrifice, as a korban. And then after he takes the sacrifice, he makes a mild blemish in the eye or the lip, which is barely noticeable and not significant for Romans, right? The Romans would still sacrifice that in their idolatrous temples, but in the Beit HaMikdash, you wouldn't. So therefore, the Romans don't realize that this is invalid in the Beit HaMikdash, but the Jews don't want to sacrifice it because, from our perspective, from Halacha, it's a mum. So the question of what to do goes before the rabbis, and they say, well, they have two possibilities. Either let's sacrifice it, because what choice do we have? Or let's kill Bar Kamsa so that he can't go back and tell the Romans. But Zechariah ben Avkulis comes in and says, no, you can't kill him because making a mum, right, making a blemish in a sacrifice is not a capital offense. And you can't sacrifice it because then people will think you're allowed to sacrifice blemished animals. Therefore, they did nothing. And because they did nothing, the Roman emperor found out that they didn't sacrifice it. He gets angry, and that leads to Korban HaBayit. And the Gemara concludes the story by saying, "Anvin tanuto shel Zechariah ben Avkulis hechriv et Beit Mikdashenu." That the humility or hesitance of Zechariah ben Avkulis destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. So Rav Dyakovsky says, look at this Gemara. Right? The Gemara tells you that there's halachic arguments on this side, there's halachic arguments on that side, but it pins the responsibility for the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash on the fact that Zechariah ben Avkulis just couldn't make up his mind. He couldn't look at the bigger picture. He couldn't make a decision that was holistic. He got caught up in the details. And that's it. So he proves from here that Chazal have this idea that to be a good leader, it's not enough to be able to make halachic arguments. Usur, mutter, that's not enough. You need to be able to have that broader perspective to respond to the needs of the community. And that's what he wants to call policy. Now, we could quibble about his exact analysis, and I want to get into his exact analysis, but he uses this to prove that policy matters. A broader perspective matters. He tells a story about this from Azriel Chaikan. If you want, you can read it. I've left it here on the sheet. But his conclusion of this story where they invoke policy is what I have right here towards the end, is Misipur Zev Shar Lamod Lekha Chashuv. This is what I want from him most importantly. You learn something very important from here. Ein psika sterilit. There's no such thing as a sterile psak. Kol psak halacha kafuf lanisibot hamyuchadot shela shoel v'shel makom migurav. Every psak has a context, a person, a place where it is relevant. And psikat halacha mitalemet b'misibot ha-she'ila v'oseket rak v'halacha bilvad. And this is where he sort of unfairly transitions, right? Meaning, first he started about policy that affects halacha itself, but now he sort of transitions to policy that's non-halachic. But anybody who deals with only halacha in the narrow sense, alula l'achshil et ha-she'el v'ha-mishal gam yachad, will cause mistakes. And then he says, that's why I don't like psak just on the telephone or the internet, because you have to know people to see the bigger picture. Okay, so that's his sort of introduction to this whole topic, that halacha is broader than usur, mutter, localized issues. It takes in the broader perspective, both in terms of formulation of halacha itself and in terms of factors that are religiously significant but maybe not technically legal. Okay? I'll pause there for a minute, okay? Before we move on to the next step, right? Any comments, questions, jokes, examples, I don't know.
So you're saying that the Kamsa Bar Kamsa story was not a halachic, it was more of a policy?
Yeah, I mean, that's what he says, right? Meaning the Gemara says, look, there's a halachic argument that you should have killed him, or not killed him. There's a halachic argument that you shouldn't bring the carbon. So on purely halachic grounds, you could justify being frozen, like Zechariah ben Avkulis, and making no decision, because neither decision was technically the right answer halachically. And yet, not only does the Gemara not commend Zechariah ben Avkulis for being a stickler of the law, right? They blame him for the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash for failing to recognize that the situation needed a broader perspective, right? And to make a decision, either decide, look, this case, you're not killing him because he made a mum, you're killing him because he is trying to kill the Jewish people using the Romans, right? Or recognizing that you can bring a carbon here, even though it's not technically a good carbon, but sometimes you have to override the law, right? That is in the rabbinic purview when absolutely necessary, but he wasn't willing to make a decision that looked beyond the narrow halachic questions, right? And that's what the Gemara blames the destruction of Beit HaMikdash on. Okay, so... Yes.
Yes. We know that no two people are identical, and we know that no two situations are identical, but it seems to me an implication that could be derived from what we're saying is that given as close to the same situation as is possible, and identify, you know, different people, the Rav who's given the Pesach, that person, that Rav, could give, like, different answers for very similar situations.
Yes, that's exactly the conclusion. That's right. And that happens all the time.
Okay.
A responsible post-take will do that all the time. Yes, that is exactly the conclusion that you draw from it, which I know some people find surprising, right? But that's exactly the point, that there are so many factors that go into halakha that are person-dependent, place-dependent, time-dependent, situation-dependent, that yes, I could give the exact same, right, to almost exactly the same question, I could give different answers. Yes, right, that's exactly, and it's not magic, right? It's because halakha is complicated and takes those things into effect. So to take a very simple example, right, and this is something that's within halakha, right? Halakha sometimes says that something is forbidden, but permitted if it will cause a significant loss. Now, many poskim say significant loss is subjectively defined, right? So the question could lead to $500 in loss, but if you're talking to your average person, $500 is a lot of money. And if you're talking to Jeff Bezos, you know, whatever. You know, when you're worth $193 billion or whatever, $500 here or there, I mean, whatever. Like, you know, his net worth based on every second change in Amazon's, you know, stock price, value, you know, changes more than that. So yeah, right? It would change whether I'm talking to Jeff Bezos or I'm talking to whatever, anybody else. Okay.
But a communal psak.
Good.
That has real implications for the individual. It may really hurt some people.
Okay, good. So Jeff says, yes, but this, as complicated as this is in the individual case, in the communal case, it's even worse. Because you're making a decision for the community by definition based on the majority, right? Or if you're responsible based on the majority. But there's always going to be someone who's left out here. Yes, and hopefully we get through this. I hope we get through this today. I put a lot here. I don't know if we'll get everything today. This is really multiple topics. So I hope we get through it today. If not, we can decide we'll break it into 2 weeks. That's also fine. But yes, Jeff, you're 100% right. Okay, so let's move now to the number one policy that drives much of rabbinic thinking. And that is what, at least in English, is known as the slippery slope argument. Okay? So what is a slippery slope argument? So I gave you Wikipedia. I don't have to read Wikipedia, but in case you want to look back, you know, for a source, there's the good type of slippery slope arguments and the bad type of slippery slope arguments. A fallacious slippery slope argument goes like this. Don't do X because it will inevitably cause Y. X is not bad. Y is bad without proving why X causes Y. Okay, that's a little bit abstract, right? But so for example, don't run a red light even at 2 in the morning, because if you run a red light at 2 in the morning, even though there's no cars in the road and you're not putting anyone in danger, you will definitely 100% smash into somebody, because you will run a red light at 2 in the afternoon, not just 2 in the morning. Okay? That's a bad slippery slope argument, because there are people in this world who are capable of distinguishing between 2 in the morning when no one's there and 2 in the afternoon. That's a bad slippery slope argument. A good slippery slope argument would be, don't run a red light at 2 in the morning. Because if we let you run a red light at 2 in the morning because you think there are no cars, so you might end up running the red light when there is a car there, right? Or you might get in the habit of running the red light at 2 in the afternoon, right? You'll basically just create a situation which could lead to danger, right? That's a legitimate slippery slope argument, because that's saying, look, I recognize that running a red light is not intrinsically bad, but getting into an accident is bad. And if we don't set some ground rules here that are true under all circumstances, then the consequences are going to be bad. And therefore, even though we acknowledge that it's not necessarily the case that you'll end up running the red light when there is cars, it's worth it to forbid it as a blanket rule to keep everybody safe, right? The difference between this, right, the good argument and the bad argument, is the good argument doesn't pretend that it's inevitable. It just says, look, here's a logical reason why it could be, if I'm not careful, letting you do something which is in itself not bad will lead to bad consequences, and therefore I make a policy decision to prevent something that is bad, right? But I acknowledge that just because you run the red light at 2 in the morning doesn't mean you're going to run the red light when there are cars at 2 in the afternoon, right? I understand that. I'm making an argument because I understand the possibility, right? Meaning, I recognize the possibility, right? The way they summarize here in Wikipedia is, if I forget about the middle ground, then it's a flaw, right? Meaning, if I deny the possibility that someone might actually end up being careful when they red lights, that's a flaw, because obviously it's possible for someone to only run red lights at 2 in the morning and not at 2 in the afternoon. But if I acknowledge that's possible, but I say that nevertheless it's not worth it, it's too dangerous to allow you to do that, so that's a potentially legitimate slippery slope argument, right? I'm not claiming inevitability, I'm just telling you, this is dangerous, and therefore I'm going to be extra careful, and we're setting up policies to prevent this from spiraling out of control, okay? This is the ABCs of all rabbinic law. This is like the number one rule in rabbinic law, okay? Right? Already, the first Mishnah in Avot, I gave you in 3, the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah, when they introduce Psak, they introduce their contributions to Torah, they have 3 major contributions, of which the third one is Asu Siag LaTorah, make a protective fence around the Torah. Right, that is one of the 3 major contributions that these fathers of the oral law give us. Make a protective fence around the Torah. Why do we do that? So what is the source for such an idea? So the Gemara has different possibilities. The Gemara, for example, here in Moed Katan, ends up concluding after several possibilities on this, the following pasuk, Ushmartem et Mishmarti. We are told to protect God's Mishmar, his laws. Asu Mishmar et Mishmarti, protect my laws, right? Protect my laws. The Gemara in Yevamot brings it up as well in terms of the derivative rabbinic forbidden categories of incest. The Gemara at the end there suggests, right, it's not quite clear whether this is actually a biblical principle or rabbinic, because the Gemara there says, Amar le Abaye le Rav Yosef ha de'oraita hi, isn't this biblical? So the Gemara says, de'oraita o perish rabbanan, it's a biblical principle which the rabbis expound. So then the Gemara says, but kol ha-Torah nami perish rabbanan, that's basically your description of all of Torah. So elami de'rabbanan across machzav alma, you're right. This notion that this pasuk teaches you to set up rabbinic law is itself only rabbinic. Now, does that mean there's no biblical source? Maybe not, but at least the classic pasuk they quote is an asmachta, and the Rishonim, right, in the Rambam, for example, he seems to reject the end of the Gemara and accept it as d'oraita. So in 7, for example, he says, asu siag la-Torah, what does it mean to make a guard, a fence around the Torah? Those decrees that distance people from sin, he quotes the Gemara as a biblical law despite the fact that the Gemara seems to reject it, and he says, from here you learn that you have to protect the Torah. A second source that is quoted in certain Midrashim is from the Nazir, where the Midrash assumes that the Nazir, he's not allowed to have grapes, he's not allowed to have anything from grapes, but the assumption of the Midrash is the real problem is wine, right? That really, really, really the Torah wanted to keep him away from alcohol. So the Gemara says, Mikol asher yasa migefen hayayin, why, if the Torah really wants the Nazir not to become drunk and drink alcohol, why does it forbid him from eating grapes? So asta Torah siag d'vareha. The Torah protected itself. Shelo yochal v'lo yishtem mikol davar nasa migefen hayayin. Kidei shelo yavo lishtot. Because if you tell him don't have grapes, he definitely won't have wine. what's the rule? Mashla. What's the mashal? Matla, but same as mashal, right? Parable in Hebrew. Amr lecha aminan lenazira schor schor. We tell a nazir, go away, right? Walk away, go around. Lekarma lo tikrab. Stay away from the vineyard, right? Meaning, our intuition is that the best way to protect the Torah is to set up fences. Now, a fence, by definition, is saying, look, really, what we're worried about is a violation of the biblical law. We don't intrinsically care about the violation of the rabbinic law. We set up the rabbinic law to protect the biblical law, right? I'm not saying that you definitely will violate the biblical law if we don't stop you with all these added derabanans, but you might, and we don't want that to happen. And therefore, we set up guards, we set up fences. Now, is this Rabbeinu Yonah adds that at some level, the principle that drives this is Yirah, right? Is Yahar Yareh Etvar Hashem, right? The reason you do this is because we value fear of God. And if you really fear God, so then you wouldn't want to suffice with just avoiding what God actually said don't do. You want to make sure that you don't accidentally end up there. You don't unwittingly end up there. Right? And therefore, he thinks that the driving principle behind these fences is fear of God. And because it expresses fear of God, he says, in a certain sense, the Midrash writes, Ki tovim dovdecha miyayin, chavivin divrei Torah, sofrim mi'ineshel Torah. At some level, rabbinic laws are actually more beloved to God than biblical law. Because the fact that we set up rabbinic law is proof that we really, really care about what God said. Now, does this apply only to, let's say, the Sanhedrin or the Gemara? So, the majority view seems no. So, if you look, for example, at the Magen Avot in the Rashbat in 9, he says, "Kol dor vador rashai l'taken takanot." Every generation has the right to set up such decrees. With what their generation is weak in. And if it weren't for these decrees, the Torah would slowly fall apart. A vineyard that is protected by a fence is not like a kerem she'eno mukaf geder. Is safer than a vineyard that is not protected. The Rambam also says this in 10, right? He says, "Gan mitver me'en verim shegazru chachamin u'mviim shebechol dor vador." This, the rabbinic power applies to the decrees that are made in every generation. So this seems to be something that is true always. There is a value to recognizing where the nation, where your generation is weak, and protecting them from serious halachic problems with protective measures. Okay? That is about a summary I could have of policy. Right? Meaning, we're not saying it's forbidden. We're saying your job is to gauge in each generation what your community needs, what they're weak at, what they need to make sure that they holistically keep the Torah better, and to institute such laws, such customs, such safeguards, right? Okay, we'll pause for a second. Any questions on that point, right? I assume this all sounds vaguely familiar. Maybe you haven't seen all the sources inside, but vaguely familiar, right? Like, this is, like, familiar. We're, like, used to this. We're, you know, anyone who knows, you know, keeps any rabbinic laws, we know. We, like, set up these, right? We don't, I don't know, what's a good example? I mean, well, pretty much everything. So much of what we do is like we weigh between milk and meat, even though biblically the only thing that's forbidden is eating meat that was cooked, meat and milk together, right? Even eating milk and meat together on the same plate, if it's not cooked, would be permitted, right? If you took a cold hamburger and put cheese on it, and you didn't heat it up, it would be kosher on a biblical level. But we don't do that, and then we extend it. Not only do we not do that, but we don't eat them at the same meal. Not only do we not eat them at the same meal, we wait between meals. Not only do we do that, but maybe we wait 6 hours, right? And we don't have the same bread at a meat meal and a dairy meal. We don't use, you know, et cetera, et cetera, right? We know there's like 20 layers of rabbinic law and custom that keeps us from ever violating the biblical prohibition of basar b'chalav. But here's where it gets tricky, okay? And this is what I want to, right, this I think is more interesting. When the rabbis do that, do they have to admit what they are doing? Because this can go two ways, right? A rabbi can say, I think that it's a bad idea for my community to do X, Y, and Z. Therefore, I'm going to tell them, this isn't usher, it's not forbidden, but I think it's a bad idea. Please don't do it. Or he could say, no one's going to take me seriously if I say this is a bad idea. Oh, sorry, one second. My kid was not feeling well and it was lying in bed, and now I hear that he's woke up and is screaming. Aaron, do you want to sit with me and I'll take you to the park when I'm done? Okay. So what do you think? I'll pause the share for a second, but the share screen. What do you think? Can he? Should the rabbi tell his community this is just policy, or should he lie? Should he say, you know what, no one's going to listen to me unless I pretend that it's law? What do you think? Right? Is that a legitimate move for him to pretend that it's law?
Is there an example of something that you might be thinking about?
Well, I don't want to bias you. But fine, you want to, fine, okay, you know what, well, let's just take it by the, right, let's just take the issue that has come up several times by the horns, okay, women's issues. Let's say a rabbi thinks that something is influenced by feminism and it will lead to something usher down the road, but this particular issue he doesn't think is actually problematic, whatever it might be, women's learning, I don't know, take your pick, right? What should he do, right, whether you agree with him or not? Should he say, people, listen, women's learning, I think it's fine, but learned women have created trouble by introducing things that are halachically problematic, so let's discourage women's learning. Or should he say, I think that women's learning is forbidden, thereby nipping it in the bud, right? Which is a better idea, or is he allowed to do that, right?
I would hope that he errs more on the honest side, trying to encourage his, you know, congregation to ask questions and to commit to a dialogue. I feel like there are groups of people, not in our particular community, but in Jewish community as a whole, that just follow what the rabbi says with no questions asked. You know, for instance, I'll give you an example. There are, I've been, we live in Manhattan, and in Brooklyn, across the way in Williamsburg, there's a lot of Hasidic communities, and they will tell you that the way they wear in their clothing is halacha. It's halacha. It's halacha. I need to wear my clothes the way I'm wearing it. It's halacha.
Good. So Malki, without realizing it, has brought us back to the version of this dispute 150 years ago, right? Before the women's issues was that one. The clothing one was actually probably the most fiery of this version. But good, that's exactly, well, this I think we'll definitely get to see today. Okay, right, so the real reason we want it is because we all have an intuition, we want honesty, right, we want integrity. Like, I'm happy for you to tell me it's a bad idea, just tell me it's a bad idea, either I listen or I don't listen. But
but I also think that when you don't, when you're not honest, you don't tell people things. You encourage something like a, I wouldn't say a cult, but you encourage people to just do things and just say that's what it has to be done without understanding the whole broad concept, which encourages, unfortunately, a negative view of the other people who may not be doing it the way you are.
Ah, good. So Malky raises another point, which is acknowledging that something is policy makes it easier, in theory, for us to coexist with people who do something different. Because if I present it as this is halacha, then the other people are violating the law. If I present it as my opinion of policy, they're not violating the law. They read the situation differently. Okay, no big deal. Or maybe it is a big deal, but it's not usher, right? Yes, right, that's another problem, or benefit of honesty, a problem of dishonesty.
Yeah, I think also I've seen that if you lock yourself into, okay, this is definitely halacha, and you cannot do this, then, I see it with kids, you're younger, you know, the next generation, so to speak, as they get more knowledge, they learn for themselves, and they see that it's not really, then your entire credibility is down out the window, and they don't believe you for anything.
Good, right? And another factor here is, yes, at some point when people discover your lies, right, this doesn't do well for you in terms of trust, right, and might have more long-term negative effects than you realize. Yes, 100%.
But also, you know, we made this distinction of a De Rabbanan, like the fence around the Torah, fence is all rabbinic, but there might be some rabbinic that is not fenced around the Torah. There may be some rabbinic on the other side of that line. And we said also that one of the key motivators for why we keep a fence around the Torah is fear of Shemayim, or awe of God. We want to protect the biblical commandment, but there may be some rabbinic that go beyond just offense, I think. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, no. So for sure, there are other types of rabbinic laws that are not offenses, right? Some of them are positive, like Hanukkah, right? Lighting Hanukkah candles is not offense. That's an active encouraging of a certain spiritual value, right?
Yes.
Martin's definitely right. This is not all rabbinic law. It's much of rabbinic law. Some rabbinic law has other goals, though. 100%. Okay, so to turn this to halacha for a second, the Rambam has a fascinating position. The Rambam writes that the difference between legitimate rabbinic law and the prohibition of Baal Tosif, of adding to the body of the Torah, depends on whether the rabbis admit that their rabbinic addition is rabbinic. If they acknowledge that what they're doing is setting a fence for the Torah, then that is a good thing and a totally legitimate expression of their authority. If they lie and pretend that what they're doing is not protecting the Torah, but they pretend that what they're doing is the law itself, then they violate a biblical prohibition of Baal Tosif. So the Rambam says, "Hoel v'yesh lebeitin l'gzor v'la'asor davar mutar v'amod yisro l'doro." Since the rabbis have the power to create rabbinic law to forbid things, etc., ma'hu zeh shi'irat Torah lo tosif alav lo tigrami menu. Then what does it mean when the Torah says, "Don't add to the Torah"? You're allowed to add. That's called rabbinic law. So he says, "Shalolah hushim al divrei Torah v'lo legro mehen v'lekvoa davar leolam b'davar shem no Torah bein b'dar shivachta bein shemusharo bal peh." Right? You're allowed to add things. So why is it? How is it forbidden to add? He says, "Keta hare katuv v'Torah lo tivashel gedi b'chalevimba." The Torah says, "Don't cook a kid in his mother's milk." Rabbinically, we understand that the biblical prohibition itself includes all meat and milk, whether it's domesticated animals, non-domesticated animals, poultry, etc. So, im yasar basara of Sorry, aval basarav mutar b'chalav min hatorah. But poultry is permitted biblically, forbidden rabbinically. So he says, im yasor basara ofa omar shu b'chalav hagdi, if the rabbis would claim that chicken and milk is biblically prohibited, harezem mosif, they would be violating the Torah. Aval imamar basar ha'ov mutar min hatorah. But if they said, no, it's permitted, v'anu nasaroto, but we are going to forbid it for policy reasons, v'nodia la'amshu gzera, and tell everyone, this is a gzera, this is a decree. Shlo yavo min adavar chova, v'yamru of mutar v'neishon paresh, etc., so they don't come to understand it, then that is, ein zem mosif el oseh siyako Torah. That is a legitimate fence. So the difference is the honesty, as Malki said before. If the rabbis are honest, totally legitimate. They're dishonest, they violate a biblical prohibition. That's the Rambam's claim. In the Midrash seems to be even more radical than the Rambam. Rav Henkin makes a big deal of this in his book, Created Equal. If I ask you, what is the original sin, right? What is the original sin? So, being influenced by Christianity, we would probably say eating of the forbidden fruit, okay, in the Garden of Eden. The Midrash and Avot Rabbi Natan say, no, there was an earlier sin. The earlier sin was that men didn't trust women and therefore lied to them about the line between policy and law. That is the original sin according to the Midrash. Not me. This is Chazal already. This is the Midrash. And I kid you not. Breishit Rabba says, Umipriya eta sherbetel chagan lo tig ubo. God says, don't eat from the fruit. Adam conveys it to Chava and says, don't touch the tree. Al tosef al dvarecha pen yochichu becha v'nechzeven. So the Midrash warns, don't add to the Torah, because that will cause falsehood. Tani Rav Chiya shlo tase regeder yoter min ha'ikar, shlo yipol v'ikatech v'netiyo. Don't pretend that the extension is the same as the primary law, because that will lead to heresy. Why? Kach amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God said, k'biyom ha'chalcham imenu. The day you eat it, you will die. V'hi lo amrakeh. Chava thought, was told by Adam that she wasn't allowed to touch it. So what happened? The snake tricked her. The snake said, what did God say? She said, God said, don't touch it, and if I touch it, I'll die. The snake said, fine. And he shoved her into the tree, and she didn't die. And she said, wait a second. That means that God was lying. It must not be a bad thing to eat the fruit. So what did she do? She ate the fruit, right? This is, I gave you the short version, but that's the version, the more elaborate one, and Avot Rabbi Natan. And therefore, it says, the first sin, the original sin was not eating from the fruit. The original sin was a man not trusting a woman by telling her the truth, which was the difference between law and policy, thereby leading her to violate the policy, seeing that nothing bad happened, and ending up violating the law and getting him to violate the law. That is the original sin, right? This is quite a radical read. You would think that this is like a 21st century, like, feminist read, except it's not. It's like Chazal said this argument, right? That is the original sin of, and Rav Hirsch loves this and makes a big deal of it. Right? He says, Al lanu lishkach et mikor hasiyagim. Never forget the first siyag, right? This is what he learns, right? Never forget the first mistake, which is, and what we learn from that is, lahavdil havdala brura beinam levein mitzvot daraita. The number one rule is distinguish between biblical law, rabbinic law, between law and policy. You think it's a bad idea? Say that. Don't pretend it is law. That is the ultimate mistake. That is how we got to where we are today, right? This is a very radical read, but also a very traditional one.
Quick question.
Yes.
In Gan Eden, what you just read, a medrash or whatever it was.
It's a Breishit Rabbah and Avot Rabbi Natan, yeah.
Okay. how do we know that Adam knew that if he told Chava, don't touch the apple, touch the fruit, whatever, but he didn't, because Hashem told him, you know, don't touch it.
No, so he didn't. That's what the Midrash is assuming, that God never told him don't touch it. He made that up because he didn't trust Chava to not eat it. So he said to Chava, don't touch it, right? Hoping that if she didn't touch it, she wouldn't eat it. But God only ever said don't eat it. Adam made up policy without telling her the truth.
Okay, I understand. So I just want to clear, because first I'm hearing of it, and it's interesting. God never told Adam that you shouldn't eat it.
No, he said don't eat it. No, God said don't eat it. Adam said don't touch it.
Right. But then Chava knew by bumping into it, because the snake pushed her into it, that rule was not a good rule.
Well, no. So the Midrash makes a more radical claim, which is, because she didn't know, because she never spoke to God, right? She didn't know that this was only policy. She thought that's what God said, and then she saw that nothing bad happened. That undermined her faith in God's law, right? Meaning, it was because she didn't know what was policy and what was law, because Adam never trusted her, that when she violated the policy by touching it and nothing bad happened, she ended up thinking that nothing bad would happen if she ate it. Right? Because Adam didn't trust her, she ended up not trusting God. Right?
Okay, I understand that. But if Adam would have trusted her, what would he have said?
God said, don't eat from the tree. And then he would have either said, God said, don't eat from the tree, end of story, or God said, don't eat from the tree, I think it's probably a good idea if we avoid touching it also. Right?
But
not, God said, don't touch.
But then she got pushed into it.
Right, but if she had known that that wasn't what God said, so then it wouldn't matter. Because if she touched the tree but knew that God didn't care, and it was just policy, she would understand why nothing bad happened. The only reason that she got confused was because Adam hadn't been honest with her.
Okay. Just trying to circumscribe the dishonesty, because I think dishonesty is used as a phrase a lot. I'm just trying to understand if Adam would have been honest, he would have said to her, God said don't touch it. Is that what we're saying?
No, that's the lie. He said God said don't touch, but God never said that. God said don't eat.
Okay.
Adam lied.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
I hear, but I just...
Curious to me that we're calling the difference between don't eat and don't touch, we're calling that, you know, we don't know what was in Adam. Was Adam trying to deceive Chava, or he just wasn't being a good communicator?
No, he was, according to the Midrash, he was trying to deceive her and make a rabbinic law, right? This is not my read. The Midrash, right, is saying this is the first rabbinic law, and it was a failure because Adam lied, right? Right? I mean, that's the Midrash's self-conception, right? Because it says it, here, I gave you an Avot Rabbi Natan. This is the Avot Rabbi Natan's comments on Ezehu Siyag. What is the paradigmatic rabbinic law? The first one, which failed because he violated the main principle, which is don't lie, right? Be honest. Okay, I see that we're running short on time, so it may be. It's good. I wasn't sure if it would be 1 week or 2 weeks, but because Baruch Hashem, everyone has good questions and comments, so we may have to divide this. But before I leave you, let me show you the opposite perspective. This is the anti-lying camp. The Maharil, however, at least seemingly, is in favor of the pro-lying camp. That's maybe too harsh, but that's what he says, sort of. The Maharil, who's one of the most important of the Ashkenazi codifiers of Minhag, 500 plus years ago, 500 and change, says the opposite. Right? We have something called an Asmachta. An asmacha is a rabbinic law that is attached to a pasuk. Most Rishonim say that what that means is it's really rabbinic, but for memory purposes, it's nice to like attach it to a pasuk. Okay, but it's really rabbinic and everybody knows it. The Maril says no. In asmachta is the following. Whenever the Gemara says something is rabbinic, but the pasuk is an asmachta, meaning the pasuk doesn't really mean it, but the rabbis attach it to it anyways, hachi peirusho. This is what it means. Vadai takanta derabananhu. It's a rabbinic law. Vehen yatu batku matulem smach mikra. They went out and found a pasuk. Vistamchu divrahem alav. And they attached their rabbinic law to a pasuk. Kidei lachnikam. To strengthen it. Sheyichu svurim duhu midoraita v'yachmirubo. So that people would mistakenly think it was biblical and thereby keep it. And not treat it lightly as rabbinic law. So the Maharil says literally the opposite of the Rambam. The Rambam says what makes something good rabbinic law is that you're honest that it's only rabbinic. And you don't blur policy and psak. The Maharil says no. You know what good policy is? Policy that you pretend is psak so that everybody takes it seriously. Those are two radically different worldviews. And we won't get to this this week, but we really do have to do it, so because it's fascinating. But I'll give you the taste. This became one of the most heated disputes of the 19th century when orthodoxy as we know it began to be created. Right? Because remember, orthodoxy is a creation of the modern period as well, meaning it's the notion that there is a movement which is actively small-c conservative is a reaction to the reform, right? The notion that orthodoxy is a a group, right, indistinct to someone else is a modern phenomenon. Both modern orthodoxy, ultra-orthodoxy, all orthodoxies, right? It's a modern phenomenon. One of the things, and this is what Malki already noted, that is typical of orthodoxy, especially the more you go, let's say, to the right, is that things that the rest of us look at and say, I mean, I understand why you might want to do that, but that's not halacha. That's minhag, that's culture, right? How you dress, what language you speak, Yiddish, English, Hebrew, right? Those things might be important, but they're not law. Don't tell me it's law. It's not law. Well, the father of Haredi Judaism, like literally the father, the Chatam Sofer, who was like the person who created this movement in its modern form, writes, Amnam ba'avanotenu harabim, in our great sins, hadar parut kabika, the nation is breached like a valley, right? There is the reform. V'ra'ui l'gdor gezer, v'lasot siag la'torah, l'hachmir, v'lo lo sivkula. Our job now is to be as stringent as possible and never add leniencies. And in this article that I have in 17 that we won't get to today, he says something even more shocking, which is, one of the ways you're going to do that is that even when things are customs, find ways to pretend that they're not customs, but that they're actually biblical law. Because it all starts with custom. If you start with custom, the next thing will be rabbinic law. By the end, you'll violate biblical law. So the only way to stem the tide is to pretend that everything is biblical and to be stricter than the law demands without telling anybody that what you're really doing is policy. Pretend that it's psak. Okay. We are at time. So let me quickly say what's left. And it's enough for a second share, so that's fine. What's left is the following. This played out in a very, very harsh way in the late 19th century. In the Psak Din of Michalovce, where the rabbis, the students of the Chatam Sofer, argued among themselves whether the proper way to respond to the modern Orthodox, or what was then called the Neo-Orthodox, was to argue that what they were doing was bad policy or to pretend that it was biblical law. This became a dispute within the camp of the Chatam Sofer. The second question is, can we actually, this we touched on last week, is what's true for the rabbis of the Gemara true for our rabbis also? Meaning, is this, do we have the same limitations? Malki's point, which is, even if it's not technically forbidden, is it a good idea to lie? And then what I think is very important, that I summarize quickly from Rav Shurlo, it looks much shorter than it is, which is, okay, if you want to make policy, even admit that it's policy, what factors do we use to determine what type of policies are good policies in a halachically practicing community, right? What makes good policy and what makes bad policy? And, you know, you can see already here, but, you know, you won't fully understand it. But as an example, Rav Henkin, in his tshuva on partnership minyanim, acknowledges that he thinks halachically women can read from the Torah and explicitly says that his only opposition is policy, right? So I forget who said it, that, well, poskim always pretend it's law. They never acknowledge that it's just a bad idea. That's not really true, right? There are poskim who, because of everything we've been talking about, are willing to put their, you know, to put it out there that there are things that are bad ideas and there are things that are usher, and those aren't always the same. I'm going to guess that based on the questions, we should continue and finish this topic next week because, you know, Baruch Hashem, everyone was involved, but that meant we didn't rush through it, which is good. I'm happy we didn't rush. But that's what we'll pick up then next week. I may have to add sources. This is probably still an hour worth, but some of the things I cut out I may include or may include some other things. We'll see. But in the meantime, thank you everyone for coming and learning and for your participation as usual. Any final questions, comments on what we've seen at least so far or what I should make sure to cover next week? Okay, I see some. Oh, there we go. I saw some people's mouths moving, but they were muted. So, okay, yeah, go.
Okay, the Hasidish movement began. I think this is more historical. Was before the Reform movement, correct?
The Hasidish, yes, Hasidim, a little bit before, and yes, meaning yes, Hasidim started before, right?
Right, but were they considered a different? I mean, again, it was a different sort of, I wouldn't say religion, but sort of sect or sort of orthodoxy.
Right. So, I mean, Hasidut did, in a certain sense, respond to similar forces that were like pre-Reform, right? Meaning it developed over a long period of time. So, like, Reform came to, like, its strongest expression in the 19th century, right? Like, 1800s Germany. But, like, you know, as emancipation was starting in different countries, right, sort of the seeds had been planted. But yeah, meaning the early Hasidut is in many ways a response to the intellectual elitism of the yeshiva movement, right, of the Mitznagdim. But Hasidim eventually become part of the broader anti-reform response, right? So, right, but yeah, I mean, if you really want to understand the reactionary element to it, right, that's what we're going to do next week. Is this halachic dispute in the late mid to late 19th century? The sort of the fathers of it were not Hasidim; they were non. Right, I mean, the Chatam Sofer is not a Hasid. Right, he's a Hungarian Jew. Right, he's an Hungarian rabbinic leader. It's a, you know, there are certain similarities, and Hasidim, you know, certain things that become part of the Haredi world become adopted by Hasidim, and eventually, right, much of the community adopts, you know, similar things. But no, right, Hasidut as a movement is not purely reactionary to Reform in the way that both modern Orthodoxy and Haredi Judaism are. Right, again, I should clarify, that doesn't mean that they're not true, right? It just means that the notion of them being a movement and having to self-define as anything but Shomer Torah Mitzvah Jews is a response, right? And once you start defining yourself in opposition, there are cultural things that get wrapped up in that, right? Again, this is not, right, obviously, I self-identify, right, with this movement, right? This isn't undermining its validity, it's just saying that the way it became a movement the way it began as a community in opposition to others is a modern invention, and certain things happened with that, right? Again, obviously the people who are Orthodox believe that the reason we do what we do is because we are authentically carrying on the tradition, but that doesn't mean that everything we do is exactly the way it was done 500 years ago. It's just that it's an authentic interpretation of that. And we think that other movements are not necessarily an authentic interpretation. But still, the way we do things is a response. And again, many people have pointed out that's why Sephardi, right, in Sephardi cultures where there wasn't reform, even in Orthodox circles, right, they're much more likely to have a sliding scale than multiple movements. Right? They're much more likely to have someone who the only shul they go to is Orthodox. They're not Shomer Shabbat, but when they go to shul, it's the Orthodox shul. Right? There are very few Sephardi Reform shuls just because their culture didn't have that same pressure. So they develop more the model of there's one type of Torah, you keep as much as you do, right? But you don't, right? And therefore the whole right reality in Sephardi communities is often very different than Ashkenazi communities, right? Even if halakhically an Ashkenazi and a Sephardi who are Orthodox, quote unquote, are not that different, I mean, we have certain different practices, but we have a lot more in common than we have different, still our attitude to how we deal with people who don't keep the same halakha as we do tends to be different because, right, they never quite developed a movement in the way we did, right? Right, we always have to be very careful on that, right? Again, I'm not arguing with the legitimacy of it, I'm just arguing, right, how did we come to self-define as we do, and what does that mean? Okay, Martin, I think you had a question also, yeah?
I'm going to have to study what we know about the interaction
with Don Aiden,
but I didn't have any other questions for now.
Okay, so I put both of the main sources here on the sheet. If people are interested, before I get to it, Rav Henkin, like I said, makes a big deal of this in his book, Created Equal, if you can get your hands on it.
By the way, I got that other paper, a book that you recommended last week about the halakha, the narrow bridge. It's a very... not for me to say,
but
it's great, fine. I enjoy it very much.
Okay, good. I'm glad. I just finished the book. I was in a few books I was in the middle of, so now I'm about to move to it. So it's good. I assumed it was good based on knowing the author, but now, good. I'm glad that it was a good suggestion. Rav Henkin's book I have already read many years ago, but his opening article, Created Equal, is about this. I mean, look, it's not surprising. Rav Henkin is... he passed away only a few months ago, but right, besides for being a tremendous Talmud Chacham, he's probably more known for, despite having written 4 halakha books and in Hebrew, plus a bunch of, and Parsha and English stuff and whatever, he's, by most people in America, is more known as Rabbanit Henkin's wife, right, as being the, right, the halakha behind, right, Nishmat, right, meaning he's quite clear where his, you know, And he, you know, part of this is his theological exploration of the way he thinks about the world, which led him to that point. And obviously, I've benefited from that in a personal way. I mean, my wife is a Yoetzet Halakha, so she studied at Nishmat for 2 years. My wife has been to, like, every one of the learning programs that exist, right? Not all of them, but many of them. To GPAT, and then to Nishmat, and then Migdalos, and Lindenbaum, and, you know, she's been to, you know, most of them. You know, my biases here are on the table, on some of these issues at least. Okay, fine. So we'll pick up with this next week, and I think you'll find the historical part fascinating and will also help us understand our historical moments by, you know, by sort of seeing how already 150 years ago people were fighting about this tooth and nail. So we'll pick up with that next week. And yeah, you know, I always put more sources on the sheet than I think we're going to read, because if there's something that piques your interest, I want you to have it on the sheet so you can look at it. So, you know, the imagery from Gan Eden is there in the Avot de Rabbi Natan and Breishit Rabbah. That was, let me just go back. It's sources 11, 12, and 13. Rav Hirsch builds on that also. And then if you have a chance, Rav Henkin's whole book, the first chapter in the book, focuses on that Midrashic tradition. Okay. Okay. So everyone, I guess, have a good day, and we'll continue with this next week. Thanks so much. And Mazal Tov again, Malki. Okay.
Thank you.